The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ. I'm Stephanie Contouris here with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham. We're going to be joined from Community Development, Rosalinda Guillen, Jose Manuel Carrillo are both going to be speaking with us. And later we'll be speaking with attorney Mike Brodsky, who defended the Facebook group Redline Salish Sea, formerly Bellingham No Dapple Coalition, against a search warrant, which was granted last week. Just a quick heads up, the congressman from the 8th Congressional District, Dave Reichert, just announced he will not be running for re-election, and I'm sure we will have at least one show about that coming up. But first, we want to talk about the big national and local news about DACA, which was a huge blow for all of us, and Dave Willingham was able to get some of the press conference that our Attorney General Bob Ferguson had today.
I'm working, through this Labor Day weekend and for many days before that on preparing a potential lawsuit, anticipating that the President would take an action similar to what he's done. So first I want to thank them. There are folks from travel ban litigation, Colleen Melody, who heads up our civil rights team, Marcia Chen in the civil rights unit, and others. But those folks have been especially involved, and again, giving up a Labor Day weekend and many other days to get us in a position to file litigation. In terms of timing, I can't get too specific. There's a lot of conversation going on right now amongst a handful of Democratic AGs. So I was on the phone this morning with Javier Becerra of California, who's a great ally on these issues. California, of course, has many, many thousands of Dreamers in that state, and Eric Schneiderman of New York. So I think it's fair to say there is a small group of about four states that have been speaking daily now for, I'm looking at my chief of staff, for at least a week on this, and working very, very closely together. And then there's a large group of states that are interested as well, potentially. I communicated to my team early on that this issue was very important to me and to the office and the people of the state and to the 19,000 Dreamers who live in Washington State. So we've been working closely with, again, just a few other states to prepare litigation. I don't want to say when that's going to come, but I think what you will see is at least one lawsuit, if not more than one, from different AGs around the country. And we're still working out some of the details about that. Do we file here in the Western District of Washington, or do we file in the Western District of Washington, or do we file another state with another state or other states? So there are some logistics to work out, but I think you'll be seeing a legal action coming very soon from Washington State and other AGs as well.
Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who has filed a multi-state lawsuit to halt President Trump's decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. The lawsuit alleges that denying protections for 18,000 Washington and about 800,000 in the U.S. so-called Dreamers, he is alleging that it is both unconstitutional and illegal, causes harm to hundreds of thousands of people, as well as, he has pointed out, employers, universities, and some of our local businesses have joined in. We are joined by Community to Communities, Rosalinda Guillen and Jose Manuel Carrillo. Thank you both so much for being here on a busy day.
Thanks for asking.
Happy to be here.
And Jose, I know that you were standing next to our Attorney General during his press conference today. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So what happened, and how did you get there, and who are you representing?
Yeah, so I met the Attorney General yesterday at the DACA rally that was held in Seattle, told him a little bit about the work I had been doing and my experience as a recipient of DACA, and he invited me to briefly talk about myself and what has been going on at the press conference. And so that's what I did today. I didn't have much time, but it's great to see the Attorney General step up and fight against the administration for DACA. But what worries me is that while everyone pays attention to DACA and the Dreamers, that the rest of the undocumented community is going to get left behind.
So let's unpack this a little bit for people who have not been paying any attention to what is DACA, why is it important, and as I said, like the people who it is affecting the most.
Yeah. So the DACA program was an executive order passed by President Obama because of pressure from activists and organizers, and also due to the lack of any sort of comprehensive immigration passed by the Congress. And it allows people who came under a certain age and who don't have any criminal record and several other restrictions to apply for a permit that allows them to work and to legally stay here and be exempt from deportation that has to be renewed every couple of years.
What's your story? I mean, what's your biography? And tell us a bit about your experience, I'll use the word, as a dreamer.
Yeah. And so I was brought here by my parents at the age of 8 from Peru, in hopes that I would be able to get a better education here and just live a better life than they did. And I came here with my brother, and I just graduated from Western Washington University and have now started working for Fighting for My Community full time.
And so you personally will be impacted by this?
Yes. I'm personally not too worried about myself. I know that with all the attention and pressure that Congress and the Senate is receiving right now, that there will probably be something, whether it's a legislative version of DACA, the Bridge Act, or some sort of Dream Act. And so in terms of myself and the other dreamers, I'm slightly skeptical, but the way it's going, it seems like there's going to be some sort of legislation passed. But I'm worried that it's going to end there. I don't think that I deserve to be here any more than my parents or any more than other members of my community who don't qualify for DACA. And although I think it's great that we acknowledge these immigrants who are coming here and doing things like becoming doctors and lawyers and teachers and soldiers, I think that sort of narrative creates a further divide within the immigrant community and demonizes and criminalizes a lot of people like our parents or those who are less fortunate and not able to go to school. Like even within DACA, only about 5% of DACA recipients are able to actually graduate college because of how difficult it still is.
So to be clear, DACA is specifically related to children like yourself who were brought here as children. And when you say making a distinction, I guess I can see where people say, oh, well, maybe I can make an exception for children who were raised here, even though some people don't even agree with that. But then people who come here as adults, then it's easier to criminalize them, people who come as adults.
Exactly. That kind of is the argument. They didn't have control over coming children and whatnot. But that fails to acknowledge the fact that the parents who brought their children here came here for reasons, and they, you know, we literally wouldn't be here without them, but also I would not be, you know, graduated from college and healthy and have had emotional support through all of that if it weren't for my parents. So you wouldn't be hearing any of these stories if it weren't for our parents and for the community. And so to make them seem like criminals and demonize them for doing what's best for their children's lives is really, really wrong. And it's going to, although it seems good to push this narrative of dreamers, it creates it's starting to create an even bigger divide. And I think it's up to the dreamers and the DACA recipients to fight back against that narrative and to fight for justice for our whole community and not just us.
I think, though, the one thing I want to remind everybody about DACA, and Jose, you know, speaks very well about how young people are looking at this, right? But when DACA was first introduced, community to community had a very strong opinion about the fact that you had to be going to school or, you know, higher education, right, or a training program. And if not, there was the option of the military. And that we had a big problem with. And so I think what a lot of folks aren't talking about right now is all of the young people that couldn't afford to go to school, that out of desperation actually joined the U.S. military, that are in the military now. And so what is going to happen with them? But also the fact that as a young immigrant, that one, and you come from a poor family, and you're in the United States, and you have to join the military, whether you like to or not, right? And so that was an option given in DACA that we were very much opposed to in the very beginning, and we spoke out pretty strongly about that. The other thing that long-term, and this is for a lot of folks out there who maybe know about how immigration law was created in the first place, you know, all of that, that there is a very ugly history in this country in the development of immigration law that is based on racism. And I actually just learned recently that one of the key mentors, I guess, or thinkers on immigration law was from Washington State, and that he was from the area of Hoquiam. I believe his name was Andrew Johnson or something like that. And he actually is one of the founders of the eugenics concept. And this whole idea of DACA, there's a narrative that has come out of immigration reform or immigration law throughout all these years. The other component of DACA that falls in with the higher education is this whole idea of assimilation, right? There's a strong push with all of these young immigrants to assimilate into U.S. society. That's part of the education. It's part of joining the military, that there is a usefulness that has to be proven by these young people in order to qualify for DACA. And we're, as a Mexican-American that grew up in this country as a farm worker, I see the narrative coming from way back in the 1920s and the way the immigration law was formed, ending up to the present day DACA program. And when I see young folks like, you know, Jose Manuel and others that are just like so much potential, so much, you know, ability there that could benefit this country, but yet even through DACA, they are being funneled into only certain particular capacities that they are going to be developed in order to be worth to this country. Otherwise, they have to leave. And I think, you know, that is a big deal for me in how we look at immigrants in this country. So it's a shift, right? It's a shift on immigration reform and what this country was really founded on and what the Constitution of this country speaks to. And there's a lot to unpack in DACA.
I just had a quick question for clarification. Immigrants or children of immigrants who've chosen the military, is there a path for citizenship for them?
No.
So they are putting their lives on the line for the country.
There is no path to citizenship for anybody in any bill or executive order that has been presented to the people at this moment.
Yeah, to just build off what Rosalinda was saying about the history of our country and the ways immigrants have been treated is the whole other aspect that connects to being funneled into assimilation of the economy. You know, you hear a lot of people talking about Dreamers. They're business leaders. They benefit our economy. They'll throw out stats of how many billions of dollars would be missed. And it really completely misses the human element. And if you think about it, who were the first people that were brought here to this country to better the economy? It was slaves. Right. And so you still see these racist roots in these arguments coming, even if they're from the side of people who are pro-immigrant. We have to start realizing that aside from the economy, these are human beings and no human being deserves to be detained and deported.
I saw a pretty on point comment on Twitter yesterday that was really calling out well-meaning allies on the left, saying when you continually talk about how useful people are or how they become doctors or how they're productive members of society, that you are making people's humanity invisible, which I thought was an excellent point. Yeah. I hear also the moderates in my head saying, well, you know, we can't fix everything at once, and this is a step in the right direction. And I mean, there's the huge amount of wrongs and the historical weight of everything that's happened in the past. And then at the same time, we're in a divided nation. We're even in a divided state, quite literally as well as politically. And is it possible to go for absolute acceptance and equality and everybody is welcome without taking those steps that are kind of unsavory compromises?
According to the Constitution of this country, absolutely. That is the whole point of the Declaration of Independence and the way the Constitution was written, the concepts and the values and principles behind it. And as I said before, I'm a Mexican-American born in this country. That Constitution is mine. And I say yes, because everybody else was able to have all of those opportunities way before we have. And so what is the difference now? I think that the other issue about DACA that is extremely painful is that in our culture, just as in your cultures, right, family is extremely important. We're all family, right? Family and community. DACA goes at the very heart of that division that Jose Manuel was talking about, where even within families, there's a division mm-hmm. being caused by somebody, some leader saying, these are the preferred ones. These are the ones, the special ones, only. And that is just like heart-wrenching that all of these legal ways are being implemented to divide our families and destroy our culture and our heritage. It's not good. It's not good at all.
And, you know, to just to tack on to the end there, it's especially bad that that values testing is done and that means testing is done in a society that so undervalues basic competence and intelligence among its existing citizens. You know, how many people would qualify under DACA that are already American citizens? It would be pretty rare. You have to be have not been convicted of a felony or a major misdemeanor. You have to have graduated high school or be discharged from the military. You have to go through an extensive vetting process, and it's really kind of disgusting and devaluing and treats people like livestock.
So when you say values testing, you're talking about rating people in
right.
that kind of scheme. You know, when I was in grad school, I met a woman who worked with adult Cambodian children who had been sent back to Cambodia. And here's the thing that blows my mind. I mean, we think about the dominant messaging is whether or not people deserve to be here, right? And I see in social media, oh, why can't they go be doctors in their own country? I see that over and over again. But what I think, one thing people don't understand is that you're raised here. A lot of children are raised here, do not speak the language, have not been in their own country. And the woman that I was talking to was going to Cambodia to finding people who were completely lost, didn't know how to speak to anybody, had no one, had no money, and they had been sent, the whole crimes thing, they had been sent back to Cambodia because maybe they tagged a building or they littered some like really gross misdemeanor that pretty much every teenager goes through in their lives.
I think that the other thing that I always ask people is like, how many of us can actually pass a citizenship test? If you went to Homeland Security and took the citizenship test to become a citizen, how many of us could pass that test? You know, and again, I've seen it over and over again with farm workers and many other communities. It's creating a subclass of people that can be easily manipulated and used for cheap labor. And, you know, that's what this country is looking at, just as an economic vehicle for the local economy. And I think that is just like, that has to end. And I think as our organization, that's what we look at. It's like, look at me as a human being. This is who I am. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's supposed to be perfect. But we are all one community. We all work and we all eat. So where is the difference between us when you get down to those basic values?
And there's so much to discuss about this. I'm hoping that we can have you back for more and more conversations. In the meantime, please go check out Community to Community and get involved, have conversations. If you have feedback about the conversation today, get on our Facebook page at CascadiaNews.net. We want to hear what you have to say. I only have a couple minutes and they have to get going, but I want to check in because once again, we are in smoke-filled skies as most of the country or much of the country is. And Rosalind, I had you on last week to talk about Sarbanand and what happened with Honesta Ibarra. Are we at the same risk now? I can't help but think about the workers in the field.
We're at very much the same risk. I mean, the investigations are still happening, but we're already getting texts and phone calls from inside. The remaining 500 plus workers in there are saying that the food's already becoming, they're feeding them less. The food's already getting worse. It is extremely hot. The companies, again, not listening to the rest breaks or the time, you know, things are almost immediately switching back. So Community to Community is looking to build the capacity to go back out there And people should not forget that this company is not going to go away easily, and we have to be watching, and we cannot have any more workers dying.
And it's the it's not the only one, just no. Because it's the only one there was a death. There's
That's
companies
right.
all over the place. So we're about to wrap up. Jose, I just want to ask you last words. What would you like people listening to take away today?
I would like you to take away not to fall into this dreamer narrative that seems good, and I know it's probably coming from a place of good intention, and to remember to fight for a whole undocumented community. One way that we're trying to do this is by having our representatives vote no on any bill that increases immigration enforcement, because all of these things like the raids, detention centers, wall, militarization, and surveillance comes from taxpayer dollars. And not only to vote no on it, but to publicly come out and say that we want cuts to that system, and that we want that money to instead be used things for our country needs, like healthcare and education. And one great page to follow, that the campaign that I'm leading, it's called Defund Hate Washington. You can find it on Facebook. You can find our petition. And tomorrow you will be seeing some posts of several DACA recipients who actually delivered letters with those demands to the offices of some of our representatives here in Washington.
Fantastic. Thank you. We'll put that link on our website as well. I know you're both extremely busy fighting the good fight, and thank you both for stopping by. We are going to be back again with Mike Brodsky just after this on Cascadia News Now.
My name's Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I'll be playing a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists, whether it's alt-country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa. There'll be music and interviews with Americana artists from a lot of countries that may surprise you. So join me every week for an hour-long musical trip across countries and continents on the International Americana Music Show.
International Americana, Fridays at 8 p.m. and Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM.
Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base, que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de Facebook.
You are listening to Cascadia News Now. Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham. I am Stephanie Contouris, and we were just talking about DACA, and we are now welcoming attorney Mike Brodsky. He is a criminal defense attorney in Bellingham, and I just want to take a quick beat of the room and pulse of the room and see, does anybody have any last words on DACA before we move on, or the smoke or Sarbanond?
Well, I guess the only thing I would add is I know that Jose expressed confidence that the issue would be resolved, but I would not be so confident, and I would encourage people to continue to press their elected representatives for resolution. I'm glad he's optimistic, but I'm not quite so optimistic.
I think I'd agree that the politics are such that tossing this off to the Republican-controlled Congress just doesn't seem like a recipe for success. Certainly doesn't seem like a recipe for good things happening to people who need good things to happen. You know, and I agree with what was said that immigration is far more complicated than just DACA. DACA is the one that's sort of on the front burner right now, but the way things are going right now, it almost doesn't matter if you're in DACA. You're eligible to be deported if you're undocumented, and that's just a tough situation for people to be in.
And I want to echo all of that, but I about Sarbanond, I wanted to say that there was just a lawsuit settlement proposed, I don't think it's been approved yet, for a dairy farm outside of Yakima where 300 workers had sued over working conditions where they had to work for 9 to 12 hours, 6 days a week, without rest breaks, without meal breaks, and they looks like they were successful in getting a $600,000 settlement. So this is not hopeless. This is not bleak. This is something to keep paying attention to and keep fighting for, because there is a potential victory here.
Or it's hopeless and bleak, but it's changing. And it reminds me of Sukuma Farms and Community Communities, very closely linked with Families for Justice. And they were, after a several-year struggle, finally able to unionize. But it is certainly not the norm for farm workers. So, yeah, so there's a lot going on there. And then we are also going to talk about other activists in the field, and Mike was defending the Facebook group, not necessarily representing the group itself, but there's been an issue with the Facebook group. This was formerly it's now the Red Line Salish Sea, and it was formerly known as Bellingham, No Dapple Bellingham. And so there was, as we've talked about on this show, there was a protest sort of at the end of what was happening with the water issues in Dakota. And the protesters there were being taken, the protest was being taken down. There was a lot of frustration in this town, and some activists, Bellingham No Dapple, decided to shut down half of the freeway. I was there as a reporter, and state troopers came to the scene, did not make any arrests, took pictures. 4 miles away, because the traffic had backed up, there was an accident. So my understanding is there is now a criminal and a civil proceeding. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know anything about a civil proceeding right now. So, there's sort of at this point, we're in the criminal investigation, not we. I don't mean to say that. They are in the criminal investigation. They're trying to, I think they have, the state or the Whatcom County has determined that a crime has been committed, two different crimes, and disorderly conduct, which can simply mean what blocking traffic, besides, you know, other ways you can, loud parties and so forth. Reckless endangerment, which I think is more of a stretch than the disorderly conduct. But they've determined that crimes were committed. Now they're investigating whether they have probable cause to arrest anybody. And that's going to be determining, A, whether, you know, if they can identify the people that were there, and B, if they can identify any kind of motivation from, I imagine, what they hope to gather from Facebook, whether people are saying what they intended to do.
So I think at this point it behooves us to switch over to Dave Willingham for just a refresher on the First and Fourth Amendment before we go any further. Dave?
Well, I am not the lawyer in the room, but...
But you're a constitutional, you know, hobbyist, at least.
I'm the one that rants about it all the time. You know, the First Amendment is supposed to protect you from... It has five freedoms, but the relevant ones here are... you know, freedom of speech, which means the government cannot police what you say, and assembly. And both of those are not absolute. There are a lot of holes there. And fourth is to be secure from unreasonable search and seizure. And, you know, I feel like, and I'm going to kick this over to the actual attorney, I feel like this is becoming just standard procedure now, where, you know, there was earlier this year, the Justice Department was going after a website. They wanted the IP addresses of everyone who visited a website for organizing against the Trump inauguration. Last year, police in Minnesota were, after the murder of Philando Castile by a police officer, they served a warrant to Facebook for his girlfriend's full social media activity to look for anything that might retroactively justify what they did. And I feel like this is just kind of becoming standard practice where, you know, in this instance, it feels like the cops have pictures of everybody that was there, but they're still digging. And is this just normal now? Is this just how things are going to be?
I'm afraid it is. I mean, we all We all tell our teenagers, don't put anything on Facebook that you don't expect to be on the front cover of the New York Times. And essentially that can happen. It can happen for, and police know this can happen. And law enforcement knows that things get put onto Facebook that may incriminate somebody. So they're searching around. And that's what the fight is going to be about in the future. And certainly I don't know how those other cases ended up, but sometimes these cases end up, most of the time they end up being fought after the fact of the search, not before the fact.
And I just want to remind everybody, you're listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ Deming Van Zandt. You are listening to Attorney Mike Brodsky with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and I'm Stephanie Contours.
Well, Mike, I want to ask you, I think for people that are listening in, what happened in Judge Snyder's court last week, and I think it was last week, and what were the arguments being made? What was the prosecutor saying, and what were you arguing as a defense attorney?
Sure. So a little bit of procedural explanation is, I think, necessary here. When they first came to me, connected with that Facebook page, and some of their attorneys that came to me about taking over the case. This is a case that had already had some pleadings filed by the Washington ACLU, and then they decided to withdraw from the case, and I took it over. What surprised me is, like, boy, I've been practicing criminal defense in Washington for nearly 20 years, and I've never had the opportunity to challenge a search warrant before. Why is that? Because search warrants are usually something that is gotten from it by a prosecutor or a law enforcement agent from a judge without a defense counsel ever being involved, before I'm ever involved, before often a crime is charged. Typical situation, there's a burglary or there's a better situation. There's some drug deals going on, and police are maybe making controlled buys from this apartment, and they go to a judge and say, hey, we made these controlled buys, and we saw some so-and-so handing drugs to so-and-so, and the judge says, well, there's probable cause to believe a crime has been committed, and that this person is committing the crime, and there's likely to be evidence of this crime in this place. So you have, I'm signing this warrant to allow you to go in. And the warrant is the exception, the big exception to this Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure. It basically says, you know, as long as you go to a judge first and convince the judge that there's a good basis to get this warrant, and the judge signs off on the warrant, you get to go in and search for those things. It gets complicated from there, but that's the basic idea. So most of the time, I never see that until afterwards. I look at the case and I say, oh, well, this warrant is defective. They were looking in places they weren't authorized to look. They didn't have a nexus to believe that their drugs would be there because he sold all the drugs out of his car. They lied to the judge about something. All these things I can use after the fact to go into court and say, judge, you should suppress this evidence against my client because they didn't follow the right procedure. They violated my client's constitutional rights. This stuff should all be thrown out.
But this is the first time that you've ever gone in beforehand.
Exactly. And that's why it was a little bewildering to me that I had this opportunity. And I thought, have I been missing something? And I talked to folks, other folks, and they say, no, this is a very unusual situation. The reason that happened was because when Facebook received the warrant that said, cough up the information, Facebook contacted folks and said, hey, you should know they're asking for this information. If you don't want us to just go ahead and give it to them, you should say something. You should hire a lawyer and challenge it in court. That's what they did. Unfortunately, we weren't successful in quashing that warrant. And we can get into the reasons why that happened, but that's essentially what happened last week.
So what was the ruling then? What was the justification for the warrant?
Well, the justification was that that they had reason to believe that that the folks that that well they had you know f- what we already talked about that being on that highway at that time could constitute a crime. They were blocking traffic. Were they endangering people? It's possible. But it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just that probable cause, that lower level to say that we think a crime was committed. And then there's the question of who committed it. Well, that's identifying the people there. And maybe they do that. They didn't take IDs, I don't think, at the scene. So maybe they do that by matching up photographs they have with people that might know them, or with posts on the Facebook. There's all kinds of ways they might be using that. And then, of course, they want to go in and see, maybe, you know, did somebody say, hey, let's go block the highway and see if we can cause an accident? Well, nobody, I'm sure, said that. But if they did, I'm sure law enforcement would like to find it out. So those are the kind of things that they're looking for. So that's the reason why they wanted access to that page.
Well, you know, this sounds exactly like the kind of fishing expedition that the whole process of obtaining a warrant is supposed to prevent or to discourage. I mean, by giving access, they can comb through, they can continue to enlarge the scope of their investigation on and on, because there's no specificity to the warrant. Is that
well, accurate? Judge Snyder ruled that there was sufficient specificity, that's a tough word, that there was a sufficient exactitude, I think is the word that they use in the case law. He ruled that because they had limited scope and time, I think 5 days before and 4 days afterwards, that they were only allowed to look at the information from this page. We did have some discussion about, well, where does that stop? Do they get to, you know, with the using the analogy of a house, a search in the house, you may have authorization to search the living room, but if there's a tenant who lives in that bedroom, you need separate authorization for it. So, and one of my arguments was, what's to stop them from looking in all these side rooms? The state pretty much said, trust us. We're not going to do that. And it's unclear to me, I'm not a technology expert, exactly what they'll get. Do they get anything that gives them access to other rooms? I have no idea, frankly.
Well, this might be jumping ahead a little bit, but there's two questions in my head, and I'll just stick with this one. One of the issues was what happens to the information, whether or not it would unnecessary information would be destroyed or whether it would be sealed. And the decision was that it would be sealed, and I don't understand that even slightly.
Okay. Well, I think, I'm trying to remember exactly. First of all, that isn't a final decision. That can always be either appealed or reopened. You know, judge, they've got what they want. What's the reason the rest of the stuff is being kept? So I think that's certainly something that could be revisited later by the individuals who are involved, who have information involved there.
But in the meantime, what's the prosecutor looking at? What are they viewing, right?
Well, I think what they said, and frankly, I don't think it's unreasonable. I think the judge is that they don't know what they have, and they won't know what they have until they look at it. I argued that a special master, or perhaps even the judge, should be the one looking at it, somebody unconnected with law enforcement, unconnected with Whatcom County. The judge did not agree with that argument, so they are having what they said they're doing is they're having a law enforcement officer. I want to say I remember that the law enforcement officer was from another county, and that the and a prosecutor who is from this office but is not involved in this particular prosecution will be kind of walled off and looking at this stuff independent of everybody else. So again, it's as I argued at the time, it's a trust us situation. You know, and I don't want to cast aspersions. I work with these people all the time, and most of them are pretty trustworthy. But I would rather not be put in the position of having to trust them. I would rather be in the position of having somebody who doesn't have an axe to grind looking at those things.
Well, I guess the term is calls for speculation. But based on your familiarity with the case, mm-hmm. Do you believe that the prosecutor has enough information at his disposal without going into this information to charge certain individuals on these what sound to me like fairly low-level offenses?
Well, and I want to urge, these are low-level offenses. These are not felonies. These are not you know, terrible strike offenses. They're reckless endangerment, I guess, a little more serious than the disorderly conduct, but they're not very serious offenses. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what they have. I don't know what else they're seeking. I'm speculating about
that. Well, I can tell you from being on the scene that there was at least two state troopers there, and that they were taking pictures of everyone in the crowd, and the crowd was waiting for them to make arrests, mm-hmm. and that they did not make arrests. So for me, I'm obviously not an attorney and just have a lot of passion for what I think is right, which obviously that's not how law works. But it seems to me like make the arrest on the scene or be done with it. And then to go after Facebook where they're, okay, so from my viewpoint, there was maybe 150 people totally at the protest. And of that 150 people, maybe about 100 went up to the freeway and some people stayed back on the street. There are 1,650 people who like this Facebook page and over 1,700 follow it. This is like blowing up a sea to catch a fish.
Right. Well, I'll go on a little rant here.
Yeah, do it.
And that is that my perception of this entire case is that this is a group of people who have a very high social consciousness, and they wouldn't have been out on a freeway risking their lives and their liberty if they didn't believe in what they were talking about. And so the question I have about this case as it's being prosecuted is, this seems to be the sort of case where you would give somebody 100 hours of community service and they would jump at the opportunity to do something like that, you know, and this seems to be an opportunity where the prosecutor might actually be able to get some of these individuals to agree to something like community service in exchange for consideration or a waiving of charges. It just strikes me that we're talking about people that were exercising a form of civil disobedience, and that, in my opinion, should be honored in our society.
I don't disagree with you, and that, you know, that could happen still. I mean, it's not too late for that to happen. They haven't even had charges filed yet, so we're way ahead of that process. So more typically, the community service would be in lieu of jail time or something like that. I certainly have had cases, you know, they do something called a stipulated order of continuance where you basically agree that you committed the crime, you do some community service and gets dismissed. But this is all premature. We don't know how seriously they're going to pursue this, who's going to be, you know, calling the shots on this. So it's really at this point unclear how that'll all play out.
Well, and I think the point that I was starting to make was it seems like people are being maybe unfairly targeted from where I stand. But when you have a warrant that affects 1,650 people more than that, then I just do not understand how this is okay.
So here's. I'll play a little devil's advocate.
Please.
If I can. The Fourth Amendment protects, they talk about an expectation of privacy. And if we can use the extremes, you know, in your bedroom, in your bathroom, you have a very high expectation of privacy in those places. When you're crossing the border, you have a very low expectation of privacy, basically none whatsoever. And in between, then there's all these places in between. Certainly, you know, if I was the prosecutor, I would argue, well, you're putting something on Facebook that's open to the public, your expectation of privacy is pretty low at that point.
But liking something on Facebook or following it, even if you don't like it. Look, I've followed politicians that I don't like. and so this is, in my understanding, gives you, and Dave, you're our IT guy, you can jump in, but it gives you access to not just what I've said, but who my friends are information.
That's the question, that were the questions that we were talking about in court, about can you go into that other room? And the prosecution was saying, we're not planning on going in the other room. We're not going to get the access to going into another room. They're getting this limited piece of data, and I'm assuming that, but I don't know. But that they're going to get limited piece of data that shows what happened in these 11 days on this website. So it's not like they're going to suddenly get access to Facebook and then be able to look in Bill and Dave's and Stephanie's accounts. They don't get to do that. So I think, there's some protection there. We did talk about one of the issues I've seen brought up is the idea of plain view, and that gets to be very, very concerning in these kinds of searches. Plain view would be if you walk into the apartment and you're looking for stolen property and you see drugs on the table, the officer sees drugs on the table, he doesn't have to ignore those drugs if they're sitting out in the open. But he can't go looking for them in places where he's not authorized or they wouldn't be. So plain view in this sense would be we wanted them to, it's very much more difficult to limit plain view in the cyber world. So
right, and that I think gets to kind of my concern with this, because as you mentioned, these are not real serious crimes, and already we have seen a tremendous outlay of staff time just from what's visible from the outside. It's probably higher inside. So if they are pursuing this the way that they are, it seems like they're hoping that there's something else here, that they're going to get to something else. And I don't know what the format is that the data they will receive, because Facebook's internal system is very complex, and it uses a database that's about making connections on the fly and determining relationships on the fly. And it's really alarming to me to have that kind of information in law enforcement, because you don't get to draw a bright line around it.
Yeah, and that's and this may be a difficult question for you to answer, Mike, but did you get a sense either from the prosecutor or from the judge that they were on very thin ice with this, and that they are actually probably making history and case law in this determination? Because this seems to be something that could go right up the chain to the Washington Supreme Court.
I don't know. I didn't feel as though this was the issues in place here were not so controversial. They really were putting it is what the state was saying is that that these people challenging trying to quash this warrant, they have no standing. They have no business even being here and talking about this. This is supposed to have been something between us and the judge, and we present the evidence, and the judge decides if there's probable cause, and that's the end of it. And these other people, they're never in the process. And in a sense, that's correct. As I said earlier, I've never seen one of these before because I'm usually not in the process. And the law is designed, and the procedure is designed, so that the person who is protecting your rights is the judge in this case, and that the judge, if the judge doesn't get it right, then you come back after the fact and say, here's where the judge got it wrong, and you get that suppressed. I don't think that's that controversial. What might be controversial is that might be changing over now is that we have such a different kind of thing that's being searched for. This data, this intangible data, and whether there's limitations on it and
right,
that sort of thing.
Well, my perception of it from the outside was that, it was being treated as a fairly routine matter by both the prosecutor and the judge, but there are certain elements of this that are not at all routine. Mm-hmm. And you've spoken to several of those, the fact that you were called in as a defense attorney on this, the fact that people involved had no standing. I mean, there's tons and tons of things that I would think would cause a judge to balk and say, I'm not prepared to issue a warrant at this time.
Well, right, and not only that, this is, I don't know if we brought this up, but this is the third time that they try to go for the warrant, which touches on everything you just said, Tim, touches on everything Dave just said about how much this is costing all of us to go after not proven crimes and not big crimes if they actually did happen or they were responsible for them. So two of the warrants had failed. According to a press release released by the Redline Facebook group, they say that after the first two warrants, the McEachran and the prosecutor's office worked with the U.S. Department of Justice to craft a third warrant. So what the heck? What was up with all of that? And how was it different than the other warrants?
Well, my understanding is that what they ended up doing is narrowing how what they were asking for. I'm not as quite so sure of the order of events, but as I was brought in later, I don't know if that's the case or not. I know that there was some assistance from the Department of Justice. I know that's a little bit unusual. At the same time, we're up here by the border, so that happens occasionally. There is some rubbing up against the federal government and their jurisdiction. And I think it was more a question of the know-how and the experience in serving subpoenas on warrants on Facebook that they got. And I agree. Are we taking a sledgehammer to a flea? I think that's the case. And that's something that if people don't like it, then they have to vote for it. They have to show up at candidates' forums. And, you know, Dave McEachran, I'm not sure. I like Dave McEachran personally. I'm not sure he's running again or not. He has been the elected prosecutor since I was a junior in high school.
Since Methuselah.
And I am not a young person. I was during the Nixon administration.
We advocate for that kind of civic engagement constantly on the show. But let's stick with jurisdiction for a minute, because I must be missing something here. I do not understand why this was a state highway. I visibly saw the state trooper there taking pictures of us. I don't even understand how the jurisdiction works with not just the Department of Justice, but how did McEachran and Elfo get involved? Right. How does that work?
The entity that enforces the laws of the state of Washington in Whatcom County is, in fact, Whatcom County. That's how Washington gives the power to Whatcom County to enforce its laws, and Whatcom County then gives it to the various municipalities and courts, what they call courts of limited jurisdiction. They don't do felonies and things like that in municipal courts. They just do misdemeanors and smaller crimes. So it happens within the state of county of Whatcom County. Whatcom County has jurisdiction over it. Who they get help from, they can get help from whoever the heck they want, who's willing to help them.
Right.
But the only people who can make an arrest there are people, you know, from Whatcom County. And then you're talking about countywide. It's basically the sheriff and the state troopers. The various municipal police forces really only have jurisdiction within those cities.
Right. Well, this was heard in the court of Judge Snyder, which is a court of unlimited jurisdiction.
It's superior. And I frankly wondered about that. I think it's only up there because he signed the original warrant.
I see. Does the fact that it's an interstate highway, does that, in your opinion, lead anything to federal involvement? I mean, it's part of the federal highway system.
I suppose if somebody was trying to make an argument for a federal nexus, they could make it there. But I don't think anybody's doing that. So.
And that relates to us being within 100 miles of the border, so God forbid the Border Patrol could wade in as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned, you know, getting involved and going to candidate forums and stuff like that. And is there anything else that people can do to be generally supportive of better privacy laws and things like that? Are there groups that you recommend? Is there anything local?
I don't think I'm the right person to be asking about that. I'm sure everybody else at this table knows more about that than I do.
League of Women Voters coming up in October.
Yep, that's one I would certainly supporting the ACLU. I think there are some people who may be a little unhappy that they didn't follow through, but they have limited resources and sometimes they have to triage. And if they thought, I think that they had challenged two of these that had failed. They felt that Whatcom County had fixed its problems and that there was no reason for them to expend more energy on it. I was willing to take up the the reins at that point, but understanding that I people with some real experience in this thought that the problems had been fixed.
So are you just procedurally and legally what's next, and have you been retained and will you continue to follow this case, or is your role complete now?
My role is complete now. It's unclear whether and the procedure for an appeal, but I'm not involved in any appeals if there's going to be any. I have not been retained by any of the individuals since nobody's been charged yet. That wouldn't make sense. So I guess at this point I'm a free agent.
Let me just, we have just a couple minutes left, and we want to hit on a couple of other things, but do you think that Judge Snyder made the right decision in this case?
I don't think he was he was incorrect by under the law. I think that if he had made a different decision and the state had appealed, they may have a good basis. There were several cases that supported the position he took. Could he have put in some more protections? Perhaps. I think he had the ability to appoint a special master, and he didn't do that. That was his decision, but I don't know that he was wrong on the law.
Well, thank you so much again, Mike Brodsky. Again, Mike Brodsky was representing the side that was saying no warrant should be issued, and that is not what happened. We hope to be speaking with Michelle Vidiola from Red Line Salish Sea in the future, and we will definitely be following this story. Just a couple of quick seconds. We wanted to touch on, we didn't get to it last week, but the Washington State Department of Commerce and the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction granted over $1.5 million, and this is part of a specifically addressing homeless youth. According to a 2017 count in Washington State, has about 4,100 homeless youth. 2,000 of them are unaccompanied by adults. Bellingham was one of 14 regions, and the consortia partnering with Opportunity Council, Northwest Youth Services, will be getting the funds for connecting with homeless students, unaccompanied youth, housing, services, and agencies. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now, a very packed show tonight. We're very, very thankful to have you, Attorney Mike Brodsky. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. And also, we were honored to have Rosalinda Guillen and Jose Manuel Carrillo from Community to Community Development. I'm Stephanie Contours, my co-host Tim Johnson, and Dave Willingham. Thanks to both of you and our fabulous engineer, Devlin Sweeney. Thank you, Devlin. And you can listen to us again. We will be on, this is Wednesday. We also air on Sundays and Mondays. You can find out more information at cascadianewsnow.com. Please join us, comment, give feedback on Facebook. You are listening to CNN on KAVZ 102.5, Deming Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.